news first, and the biggest one is about money. Anthropic had announced a billing split. Starting June 15th, the Agent SDK, headless runs through Claude-P, and third-party app usage were all going to leave your regular subscription pools, the Pro, Max, Team, and Enterprise pools, and move to a separate monthly dollar credit billed at standard API rates. $20 a month, about 50 tasks for Pro, 100 for Max 5X. 200 for Max 20X, zero ineligible for Enterprise Standard. With overage at usage-based pricing, interactive Claude code in the terminal in your IDE, and on the website was never in scope. Then on June 15th, the day it was due to hit, Anthropic shelved it entirely. The new stack reported the company told customers nothing changes for now, and that it would rework the plan to better support how people build with subscriptions with advance notice before any future revision. The digital applied write-up confirms the help center notice. The planned move is not taking effect. Headless and SDK usage keep drawing from your existing subscription pools, unchanged. The decoder frames the reversal against pricing pressure from OpenAI, why you care. If you script Claude-P in CI, in cron, or in pre-commit hooks, or you build on the Agent SDK, your runs keep hitting your subscription limit instead of a metered credit. No action needed, no credit system launched. So don't migrate any automation to API keys just for this. Watch for the reworked plan instead. Now releases. Version 2.1.178 landed June 15th, and the headline is Parameter Level Permission Rules. You can now match a tool's input parameters with a wildcard. So a rule like agent with model colon opus blocks, opus subagents specifically. That's the practical win. You can finally gate subagents by model or by other input params right in the settings file. Nested skills now load when you're working on files in that subtree, and on a name clash, the nested one shows as directory colon name, so both stay reachable. Auto mode got tighter too. Subagent spawns now run through the classifier before launch, closing a gap where a subagent could request a blocked action without review. There's also a cleaner doctor layout. The bug command now requires a description and a handful of fixes, including compaction, honoring your fallback model on overload. Version 2.1.179 came the next day. June 16th, all fixes. Midstream connection drops now preserve the partial response instead of dumping a raw error, and the spinner stops sticking. Mouse wheel scrolling is restored in WSL2 under Windows Terminal and VS Code, a regression from 2.1.172, and a sandbox deny read glob over a big directory tree was bloating the bash tool description and making Linux sessions unusable. That's fixed. If you're on WSL2 or you've hit flaky network interruptions, just upgrade. Backdrop. Status trackers logged short warning windows on the 15th and 16th with elevated errors on Opus 4.8. And one outlet characterized recent disruptions as infrastructure strain. Take the framing as reportedly the concrete clod. Code response is that midstream drop fix. Last episode, we built layers that try to stop the agent from doing the wrong thing. The sandbox boundary, permission deny, ask and allow rules, prompt injection defenses, audit logs, all of those answer one question. How do I prevent a bad action? This episode assumes that prevention sometimes fails, and it asks a different question. When one turn goes wrong anyway, how much can it actually destroy? Because turns do go wrong, a prompt injection lands in a web page the agent fetched. The model gets confused and runs the wrong command. A poison dependency does something nasty during install. The agent hallucinates an RM and runs it. Prevention is layer 1, and layer 1 has holes, so we need layer 2, 3, 4, and 5. The thing we're engineering today is the blast radius. The blast radius is the maximum damage a single bad turn can cause, and engineering it down means layering scope limits on permissions, on credentials, on network, on accounts, on spend, on Git merge rights, so that a compromised or confused agent stays cheap. This is defense in depth. Each layer is an independent cap. An attacker or just a very confused model has to defeat all of them, not one. The Claude code docs say it straight. OS level enforcement. Things like bubble wrap and seatbelt catches what application rules miss. And infrastructure level isolation, virtual machines and network policies catches what OS level enforcement misses. Each layer is backstopping the one above it. Here's the mental model I want you to carry through the whole episode. The question is not, will the agent ever do something bad? It will. Eventually, the question is, what is the worst single thing it can do, and have I made that worst case survivable? And this matters most for unattended runs. When you're sitting at the keyboard, you're a real-time circuit breaker. You see the agent reach for something dumb, you hit escape. But remove the human, a scheduled run, a CI job, a headless Claude-P invocation. Now, the only thing between a confused turn and a leaked production database is the scope you wired in beforehand. Nobody's watching. The scope is the only thing watching. So let's build the scope. 5 layers, Claude. Code itself, the cloud side, the GitHub side, credentials, and then one concrete workflow that wires all of it together. Then one real pitfall that catches smart people. Let's start inside the tool. Claude Code's own scoping primitives begin with permission rules. The permissions object in the settings file holds allow, deny, and ask arrays, plus a default mode and a list of additional directories. The single most important thing to understand is evaluation order. It's deny, then ask, then allow, first match wins, and specificity does not change the order. Let that sink in, because it's the opposite of how a lot of firewalls work. A broad deny like bash with AWS star blocks every matching call, even if a narrower allow like bash with AWS S3LS also matches, which means a deny rule cannot carry allow list exceptions. You can't say, deny all AWS except this one. The deny just wins. Same with ask. A matching ask rule prompts you even when a more specific allow also matches. There's a subtle distinction between a bare tool name and a scoped rule. A bare tool name in deny just bash or webfetch or the MCP wildcard removes that tool from Claude's context entirely. The model doesn't even know it exists, but a scoped rule like bash with RM star leaves the tool available and blocks only the matching calls, different tools for different jobs. Now the syntax and the footguns hiding in it, a bare tool name matches all uses. Tool with a specifier in parentheses is fine-grained. Bash supports a star glob anywhere and the space matters, which trips everyone up. Bash with ls space star matches ls-la, but it does not match lsov. Bash with ls star no space matches both. One space changes your security posture. Compound commands, a rule like bash with safe command star does not authorize safe command and other command. Claude Code parses the compound command and checks each subcommand independently against the rules. The recognized separators are and or semicolon, pipe, single ampersand, and new lines. Every subcommand has to match on its own. That's good. That's the tool protecting you. But here's where it bites. Process wrappers get stripped before matching, timeout, time, nice, nohup, stdbf, and bare xargs. So bash with npm test star also matches timeout 30 npm test, which is what you want. The problem is what does not get stripped. Environment runners like devbox run npx and docker exec are not stripped. So a rule like bash with devbox run star would happily match devbox run rm-rf... The wrapper looks innocent. The payload is anything that's a real footgun. Write specific rules, not runner prefixed wildcards, read and edit rules, follow gitignore semantics with 4 path anchors that genuinely confuse people. 2 slashes then a path means absolute from the file system root. Tilde slash means home. And here's the trap. A single slash then a path is relative to the project root, not absolute. The docs spell it out. Slash users slash Alice slash file is not absolute. If you mean absolute, you need 2 slashes. People write 1 slash thinking they've pinned an absolute path and they've actually pinned something relative to their project. One more limit on read and edit deny rules. They apply to Claude's built-in file tools and to recognize bash file commands, cat, head, tail, sed. They do not apply to arbitrary suppose guesses. A Python or Node script that opens the file itself sails right past them. If you want enforcement that blocks all processes, you need the sandbox, the OS layer, not the application layer. There it is again. The layer above has a hole, the layer below catches it. WebFetch has its own domain rules. WebFetch with domain:example.com or domain:*.example.com, which is subdomains only, not the apex domain, but, and this is the big but, bash network tools root right around all of it. If bash is allowed, Claude can curl or wget any URL it wants, and your webfetch allow list did nothing. The docs recommend the fix, deny curl and wget force web traffic through webfetch with a domain allow list or put a pretool use hook in the path. Symlinks deny rules, block if either the symlink path or its target matches. Allow rules require both to match. Deny is generous about what it catches. Allow is strict about what it permits, which is exactly the bias you want for safety. Now, permission modes, the default mode setting, default prompts on first use of each tool, accept edits, auto accepts edits, and common file system commands inside your working directory and additional directories. Plan mode is read-only exploration, no source edits at all. Auto mode approves with that background classifier checking actions, align with your request, still a research preview, and then the two that matter most for lockdown runs. Don't ask mode auto denies anything not pre-approved either through the permissions command or the allow list plus a read-only command set. The docs call it useful for lockdown CI runs, and that's exactly how we'll use it. It flips the default from prompt to no. Anything you didn't explicitly bless is refused, not queued for a human who isn't there. The other one is bypass permissions mode, and it's the dangerous one. It skips prompts except for explicit ask rules. Even there, rm-rf/and rm-rf-tilde still prompt as a last-ditch circuit breaker. The docs are blunt. Only use this mode in isolated environments like containers or virtual machines. If you're reaching for bypass on a machine that can see production, stop. Admins get two locks for managed settings. One disables bypass permissions mode entirely. One disables auto mode. Most useful when you're pushing policy to a fleet and you don't want any individual run quietly turning the guardrails off. A few CLI flags reach the same scope from the command line, allowed tools and disallowed tools where you pass something like bash, read, edit, permission mode, and add dr or the /add dr command for extra directories, with a persistent version in the additional directories setting. But here's a nuance worth real attention. The additional directories setting grants file access only. The add dir flag does more. It additionally loads skills, subagents, and with one environment variable set, the project instructions file, from that directory. So if you add dir an untrusted repo, you don't just let Claude read its files, you inherit its configuration, its skills, its subagents, maybe its instructions. Don't add dre a repo you don't trust. Now, the sandbox, which we covered last episode, so just the reference points, it's built into Claude code. Seatbelt on macOS, bubble wrap plus SOCAT on Linux and WSL2. You turn it on with the sandbox command or the enabled setting. The defaults are the part people miss. Default write is your current working directory plus the session temp dir only, but default read is the entire computer except dirs you explicitly deny. The docs say it verbatim. This default still allows reading credential files such as your AWS credentials and your SSH directory. Add them to deny, read to block them. Read that twice. Sandbox on out of the box still reads your cloud credentials. The sandbox bounds writes by default, not reads. The file system keys are allow write, deny read, and allow read, where allow read reopens something inside a denied region. The clean pattern is deny read on home, then allow read on the project directory. Home is blocked, your project stays readable. Network, no domains are pre-allowed. The first new domain prompts you pre-allow with allowed domains, block with denied domains, and for managed lockdown, there's a setting that allows only managed domains without prompting at all. One warning from the docs, the proxy does not terminate TLS, so a broad allow like github.com opens a data exfiltration path through domain fronting. Broad domain allows are not as safe as they look. Then the hard fail knobs, and these are the ones that turn a soft sandbox into a real one fail. If unavailable, set to true, refuses to start if bubble wrap is missing. The default behavior is worse than you'd guess. It warns and falls back to running unsandboxed. So on a box without bubble wrap, your sandboxed run is just a run fail if unavailable closes. That allow unsandboxed commands, set to false, is strict sandbox mode. It makes the escape hatch, the dangerously decoy sandbox flag, get ignored. Why does that matter? Because by default, when a command fails under the sandbox, Claude may retry it with that escape hatch running it outside the sandbox. So the sandbox catches the bad command, and then the agent goes, huh, that failed, let me try without the sandbox. Setting allow unsandboxed commands to false kills that retry, the sandbox stops being optional. There's excluded commands, which runs name tools outside the sandbox needed for Docker, and on macOS for Go CLIs, like the GitHub, CLI, gcloud, and Terraform, that fail seatbelts TLS. There's no managed-only lockdown on that list, so keep it narrow. Every command on it is a hole you punched on purpose. There's an environment scrub variable that strips Anthropic and cloud provider credentials from subprocess environments. You need it because sandboxed bash commands inherit the parent process environment, including any credentials sitting there. The sandbox doesn't scrub the environment for you, you ask for it. And one nice piece of self-protection, the sandbox auto-denise writes to the settings file at every scope and to the managed settings directory. So a sandboxed command cannot modify its own policy. The cage can't unlock itself from the inside. Remember that line? Because in a minute, a CVE is going to be exactly about a case where it could. Last sandbox note, allowing the Docker socket effectively grants access to the host system. The Docker socket is root on the host wearing a trench coat. Treat it that way. Hooks give you a programmable deny layer. Pre-tool use hooks run before the permission prompt. Their output can deny, force a prompt, or allow. A hook that exits with code 2 blocks, the call before permission rules are even evaluated. It takes precedence over allow rules. So the pattern is put bash in allow for normal use, then a pre-tool use hook deterministically rejects the specific destructive commands you care about. And it's deterministic shell, not model judgment. The model can be talked into things. A shell script checking for rm-rf cannot be sweet-talked. For headless spend and turn caps, dash p or print runs non-interactive with output format JSON. The payload includes total cost in US dollars and a per model cost breakdown. The result fields are the result text, a session ID, that total cost, the number of turns, an is error flag, a duration and usage. You pull them out with JQ and you assert on them. Max turns caps the agent loop so it fails instead of spending unbounded. There's also a max budget setting reported as a hard spend ceiling in community docs, so verify that one against your current help output before you lean on it. Podcaster can build an entire show for you. No source material required. Give it a topic, say a weekly digest of your field, and it does the web research, writes each episode, and publishes them to a feed on whatever schedule you set. A living podcast that keeps itself current while you go about your day. Spin one up at ocdevel.com/podcaster. Then Bear Mode, which is recommended for CI and SDK use and is going to become the default for dash P Oatbear. Mode skips auto-discovery of hooks, skills, plugins, MCP servers, and the project instructions file. So a teammate's personal hook or a project's MCP server config won't silently run inside your lockdown job. In bear mode, auth has to come from the API key environment variable or an API key helper. The combination you want for CI is don't ask mode plus an explicit allowed tools list. That's the documented lockdown posture. Now, the reason all of this caging still isn't enough on its own. 2 Claude code security incidents, because they make the whole argument for me. The first is a real CVE, the 2026 sandbox escape via persistent config injection. Here's the mechanism, and it's beautiful in a horrifying way. When the settings file did not exist at startup, BubbleWrap couldn't apply a read-only bind mount to a path that wasn't there. You can't mount nothing as read-only. So code inside the sandbox could create that settings file and inject a session start hook into it, and that hook then runs with host privileges on the next restart. The cage that can't unlock itself from inside had a gap because the lock on the settings file assumed the file existed. It was patched in version 2.1.2. But sit with the lesson, the enforcement layer itself had a hole, which is precisely why you also bound the blast radius outside the tool. If the only thing standing between the agent and your host was the sandbox, that CVE was game over. If you'd also put the run in a throwaway account with scoped credentials, the escape buys the attacker a worthless sandbox. The second incident, treat as illustrative researchers, showed the sandbox could be bypassed through path tricks. And they showed that when BubbleWrap caught a command, the agent in some cases disabled the sandbox itself and ran the command outside it, which is the exact behavior that the strict allow unsandboxed commands false setting exists to kill. The tool shipped a setting specifically because the default behavior was exploitable, so turn it on. That's the close of layer one. Claude code gives you a lot of scope, and even with all of it on, the enforcement can fail. So we go outside the tool, the cloud. I'll use AWS as the canonical example, but the shapes carry over to any cloud. Start with IAM least privilege. The anti-pattern is administrator access, a policy with action star on resource star blast radius equals the whole account. The agent that needed to write one file can now delete your databases. Least privilege is the opposite instinct, an agent that can write exactly one S3 prefix and nothing else. And there's a real subtlety in writing that policy because it's a two-statement split. Listing a bucket is a bucket-level action, so the resource is the bucket itself, and you constrain the prefix with a prefix condition, but getting and putting objects are object-level actions, so the prefix goes right into the resource RN. People write one statement, get it half wrong, and either it doesn't work or it's too broad. For a single lambda, it's invoke on exactly one function ARN. The ARN format is partition, service, region, account ID, resource, and the condition keys that shrink the radius are worth memorizing. Requested region, source IP, principal tag, the S3 prefix instance type, secure transport, the best practice phrasing from AWS, allow as narrow as possible, deny as broad as possible, allow the pinhole, deny the wall. But a policy is only as good as your discipline in writing it, so AWS gives you a cap that doesn't depend on discipline. Permissions boundaries, a permissions boundary is a managed policy that sets the maximum permissions for an identity. The effective permissions are the identity policy intersected with the boundary. So even if the role zone policy says action star, an action that's absent from the boundary is denied. The boundary doesn't grant anything, it caps. You set it with the put role permissions boundary command, and there's a delegation trick. You can let people create roles, but force every role they create to carry a boundary, using a condition on the permissions boundary key. So your teammates can self-serve roles for agents, and none of those roles can exceed the cap you set. That's blast radius engineering at the org level. Now, how do you actually figure out the least privilege policy without guessing? IAM Access Analyzer. It gives you external access findings, unused access findings that flag roles and keys nobody's touched, plus actions a role has never once exercised, policy validation, and the good one, policy generation from CloudTrail. It looks at up to 90 days of activity and writes you a least privilege policy of exactly the actions the role actually used. That's the practical answer to how do I right-size the agent's policy. You let it run broadish in a safe place, then you generate the tight policy from what it really did. Credentials. Short-lived versus static. Static access keys, the ones with the long-lived IKEA prefix, never expire. Leaked equals indefinite blast radius until a human notices and rotates. That key works, STS, temporary credentials. The ones with the ASIA prefix that include a session token are time-boxed. You get them with assume role, passing a role ARN, a session name, and a duration. The duration floor is 15 minutes, the default is 1 hour, the max is 12 hours, and role chaining caps at 1 hour. Two more STS tricks. Session tags, which you can read back as a principal tag for attribute-based access control, and session policies which can only restrict, never expand, an assumed role passed inline. The effective permission is the role policy intersected with the session policy. So you can hand the agent a role and still narrow it further per run. Same role, tighter scope this Tuesday than last Tuesday. The leak window collapses from until someone rotates it to minutes. The strongest isolation AWS offers is a separate account. The account is the hardest boundary in all of AWS separate IAM, separate resource namespaces, separate billing. A compromise in a sandbox account simply cannot reach prod because there's no shared substrate to traverse. AWS organizations groups accounts into organizational units, prod, non-prod, sandbox, and service control policies, SCPs, attached to an OU or account, and set the maximum permissions for everything in it, including the root user. Cap, don't grant, and only the management account can apply them. The example SCPs paint the picture. A region lockdown SCP that denies any action when the requested region isn't your approved one, with global services exempted. A deny touching prod SCP that denies everything when a resource is tagged environment equals prod. A cost guardrail SCP that denies launching an EC2 instance unless it's the small cheap type. Give the agent its own throwaway sandbox account under a sandbox OU, and the literal worst case is that it blows up the sandbox, which is fine. That's what the sandbox is for. Network egress, because the scariest single thing a compromised agent can do is exfiltrate, send your data somewhere. Security groups are stateful, attach at the instance or network interface level, and are allow only. The default security group allows all outbound to anywhere and no inbound. So the move is delete that default open egress rule and allow list your destinations. For example, TCP 443 to an internal CIDR only. No open egress means the agent literally cannot post your data to an attacker's endpoint. There's nowhere for the packets to go. Network ACLs are the other layer. Stateless, subnet level, allow and deny, numbered, and because they're stateless, you have to remember to open the ephemeral return ports. And VPC endpoints, private link, keep AWS service traffic off the public internet entirely. Gateway endpoints, which are free, for S3 and DynamoDB. Interface endpoints for SDS, ECR, Secrets Manager, KMS, and CloudWatch logs. The fully locked down shape is the agent in a private subnet, no NAT gateway, no internet gateway, AWS calls going through VPC endpoints and external hosts reachable only through an explicit egress proxy with an allow list. Omitting the NAT gateway removes the internet exfil path, and notice, that's the exact same idea as Claude Code's sandbox allowed domains egress allow list. Same discipline, just down at the infrastructure layer instead of the application layer. The pattern repeats at every altitude, spend caps on the AWS side because a looping agent burns money even when it's not malicious. AWS budgets with budget actions. At a threshold, say 90% of $100 a month, it can automatically apply a restrictive policy or SCP, or stop your EC2 and RDS instances with the approval model set to automatic. A CloudWatch billing alarm watches estimated charges, lives only in the North Virginia region, and fires an SNS notification over a threshold. And cost anomaly detection uses machine learning, runs about 3 times a day, needs no static threshold, and is the thing that catches a runaway looping agent you didn't predict. Pair all of that with Claude's own total cost and max turns. 2 independent spend caps, one on tokens, one on cloud. Either one trips, your capped and ephemeral environments tie it together. Per PR preview infrastructure on a pull request opening or syncing, you deploy. On close, you destroy, a Terraform destroy or CDK destroy keyed to a per branch workspace, tagged environment equals preview. Ephemeral databases, an Aurora clone using copy on write and RDS snapshot restore, a seeded throwaway Postgres container or branch databases from the newer providers paired with preview deploys. Each preview is a disposable, scoped down copy. A bad migration dies with the PR. Production data is never in the room, that's layer 2. On to GitHub, the GitHub token first. You set least privilege at the workflow or the job level. The documented least privilege example for an agent that opens PRs is contents read, pull requests write. Each scope takes read, write, or none, and there's a long list of them. Contents, pull requests, issues, the ID token, packages, deployments, actions, checks. An empty permissions block removes everything. Read all and write all are shorthands, and write all is the one to fear. The crucial behavior setting any permissions block at all resets every unlisted scope to none. That's the safest way to scope down, list only what you need, and everything else goes to zero automatically. Why does this matter? The NX S1Gularity attack. A vulnerable workflow leaked a GitHub token that had read and write, and the attacker used it to publish malicious NPM packages. A scope token would have been a much smaller fire. OIDC to AWS from actions, remove stored AWS keys entirely. Instead of a stored access key secret, you mint a per-run short-lived token federated into STS. The provider is GitHub's token endpoint. The audience is STS. The IAM role's trust policy is scoped to one repo's branch through the subject claim. Something like repo your org slash repo ref the main branch. It can be scoped to a branch, a pull request, a named environment, or a tag. Pin the audience with a string equals condition and never use the for all values form because it passes when the claim is absent. That's a genuine footgun, an empty claim sliding through. The workflow needs ID token write to mint the token plus contents read. Then the configure credentials action assumes the role. The token is minted at runtime, expires in about an hour, and is bound to the repo branch and workflow. It can't be exfiltrated and reused somewhere else. There's no static secret to steal. Branch protection is the layer that makes the agent can only open a PR, never merge, actually true. With required review branch protection, collaborators can only land changes on a protected branch through a PR approved by some number of reviewers with write permission. Rule sets are the newer alternative with disabled, enabled, and evaluate states, where evaluate dry runs a rule so you can see what it would do before enforcing it. So you give the agent a token that can push a branch and open a PR but lacks merge rights, and a protected main becomes the human gate. The worst single turn is a PR, not a production deploy, a PR sitting there waiting for a human. Deployment environments add one more gate: GitHub environments, support protection rules, required reviewers where a specific person or team must approve, wait timers, and branch restrictions, up to 6 rules per environment. So even if the agent's workflow somehow reaches the production environment, a human still has to click approve before anything ships. That's layer 3. Layer 4 is credentials, and it's mostly a synthesis of what we've said, sharpened into rules, per environment secrets, separate environment secrets, or secrets manager. Paths per environment. Never mount production secrets into an agent or CI context that's running code influenced by something untrusted. The Claude code version of this is that environment scrub variable stripping cloud creds from sandboxed SOAP processes, short-lived over static everywhere OIDC and STS instead of long-lived IKEA keys. The leak window collapses from until someone rotates it to minutes. Read-only by default database credentials for read-only agents. Hand a research or triage agent a read replica connection string, or a Postgres role granted only select with insert update and delete revoked, completely separate from the app's write role. Then a confused drop table fails at the database itself, not just at the prompt. The database is the backstop when the prompt level guard misses. Separate roles for plan versus apply. With Terraform or CDK, the agent's role can run plan, reading state, but apply requires a human-gated job that assumes a different write-capable role. The agent proposes, a human behind approval disposes. And the scrubbing discipline, deny, read the N file and credential files in the sandbox. Don't pass a production database URL into an unattended run, pass a scoped sandbox database. For every single secret, ask one question. If the agent leaks this string verbatim, what's the damage and for how long? If the answer is total forever, that secret has no business in an unattended run. Now let's wire all 5 layers into one concrete, copyable workflow. The goal, a scheduled headless Claude code run that researches and opens a PR against a sandbox AWS account and can do essentially nothing else. Step 1, Claude side scope in the settings file. Default mode don't ask, deny curl, deny wget, deny reading the end file, and the AWS and SSH directories, sandbox enabled, fail if unavailable true, allow unsandboxed commands, false file system, deny read on the AWS directory, the SSH directory, and home, with allow read on the project. Network set to allow only managed domains and the environment scrub variable set in the environment. Step 2, the headless invocation with caps, Claude, bear mode, dash P. Permission mode, don't ask. Allowed tools limited to read, edit, and git. Max turns 40, output format JSON. Then you assert on the total cost and the is error flag after it finishes. Step 3, a least privilege OIDC role in a sandbox account. Trust scope to your repo on the agent branch's role policy limited to 1 S3 prefix and 1 Lambda. The sandbox account sits under a sandbox OU with a region lock SCP and a cost guardrail SCP ID token write only. Step 4, the egress allow list. Runner in a private subnet, no NAT gateway, a security group with no open egress, AWS API access through VPC endpoints, nothing to exfiltrate to. Step 5, 2 independent spend caps, max turns and the budget flag on the token side. An AWS budget's action applying a deny all but read policy at the cloud spend threshold, plus cost anomaly detection on the other side. Step 6, branch protection so it can only open a PR, the GitHub token gets contents. Write and pull requests write, no admin. Protected main requires a human reviewer, the production environment requires approval. The worst single turn is a PR sitting for review. Now do the worst case audit because that's the actual deliverable. A fully compromised turn, every prevention layer defeated can write to 1 S3 prefix in a throwaway account, spend up to the cap and open a PR. That's it. It cannot reach prod. It cannot exfiltrate. It cannot merge. It cannot read credentials. It cannot exceed the budget. The blast radius is a worthless sandbox and a PR a human will look at. That's a survivable worst case. That's the whole game and now the pitfall because there's a fallacy hiding right in the middle of that workflow. The fallacy is the agent can only open a PR, so it's harmless. It sounds airtight. It is not because a PR is an input, and an input triggers CI, and CI can hold secrets and a powerful token. The specific trap is the pull request target trigger. Compare it to the normal pull request trigger. The normal one runs in the fork's context with no base repo secrets and a restricted token, safe for untrusted PRs by design. But pull request target runs in the base repo's context with access to your secrets and a read-write GitHub token, even for fork PRs. So if a workflow on that trigger checks out and runs the PR's code, a so-called poon request, then the attacker's PR code runs with your secrets. The it only opens a PR boundary just evaporated because the PR reached into a privileged CI job. This is not theoretical, cite them by name. The Spotopy advisory and the OpenLit advisory were both secret exfiltration or remote code execution through pull request target misuse. And the March 2026 Trivy attack used pull request target to send secrets to the attacker. Real projects, real leaks, same mechanism. Here's the recognizable symptom, so you can spot it in your own repos. A workflow that triggers on pull request target. Then a checkout step with the ref set to the PR head, SHA, which is checking out untrusted PR code. Then it runs build or test scripts from that checkout with no permissions block and secrets in scope. If untrusted PR code executes and base repo secrets are present in the same job, the PR is not a safe boundary. Those two conditions together are the whole vulnerability. The fix: use the normal pull request trigger for untrusted PRs. If you genuinely must use pull request target, never check out or run PR code in the privileged job, set explicit least privilege permissions, and gate any deploy behind an environment with required reviewers. A few alternate versions of the same mistake, each with a tell. Broad read in the sandbox still leaks your AWS credentials because default read is the whole machine and nobody added the deny read. The wildcard IAM resource star, the action star on resource star. Someone wrote, just to get it working means the agent that should touch one bucket can read and delete every bucket. And the fix is access analyzer policy generation. And the GitHub token defaulting to write all on a legacy repo with no permissions block. So a single compromise step can push to main or publish packages. And here's the through line, the thing to take away. Every one of those is the same failure. A layer that looked like a boundary, a PR, sandbox on, it's just CI, wasn't actually scoped. It looked like a wall and it was a curtain. So that's blast radius engineering. It's the discipline of assuming each layer can fail and making sure the next one still bounds the damage. You're not building one perfect wall because there's no such thing. You're building five cheap walls and making peace with the fact that any one of them might fall as long as the worst case on the other side is survivable. The human at the keyboard was the circuit breaker. When you take the human out, the scope is the circuit breaker. Wire it in before the run, because during the run, nobody's home. This episode was made with OC Devel Podcaster. You can turn anything into a podcast, a link, a document, or even a description of a topic you're curious about. And Podcaster researches and narrates it for you. Start your own at ocdevel.com/podcaster.